As you can, or should be able to see from the screen, the title of the lesson this morning is How a Person Lives On. And the expression lives on is in quotes because that is an expression found in the Bible. It's actually found, I believe, just one time, specifically in Hebrews 7, verse 8, where it is a statement made in reference to Melchizedek. Let me start off this lesson by observing that on April 19th, 1951, to a joint session of Congress, General Douglas MacArthur made a statement that became famous. That statement was, "Old soldiers never die. They just fade away." Well, of course, experience makes it obvious that no one, whether he's an old soldier or not, never dies. In other words, all people die. Not only do we know that from experience, but we also know that from the testimony of the scriptures, because the scriptures themselves testify that everybody dies. The only exceptions to that would be Enoch and Elijah mentioned in the scriptures. And, of course, those who are now living, they're the only ones who have not died. In Psalm 49, verse 9, the point is made that, you know, there is no way that you can keep your brother from death, no matter what effort you make. You cannot keep him from death. In Psalm 49, let's see, yeah, Psalm 49, verse 9, it says that he should live on eternally, that he should not undergo decay. And of course, actually in the context, the fact that he would live on and not undergo decay is denied. Hebrews 9, verse 27 says, Everybody dies. Now, on the other hand, Scripture also testifies that in some senses or in some ways, nevertheless, people live on after death. Hebrews 7, verse 8 confirms this. It says there regarding Melchizedek, and actually let me get over there and read that scripture very specifically. It says, "And in this case, mortal men receive tithes, but in that case, one receives them, of whom it is witnessed that he lives on." Again, as far as I know, this is the only place in the scriptures which uses that exact expression, lives on. Now, there may be some other scriptures that speak of, use the expression live on, but lives on in the singular in reference to Melchizedek is the only place where that exact expression is used. Hebrews 7, verse 8. Now, of course, when it speaks of Melchizedek or someone else living on, scriptures do not use that expression in reference to, in the same literal sense or state of being in which people had previously lived or existed. They live on, but in a different way than they had lived on earth. Nevertheless, this expression gives us occasion to consider some important ways in which people might live on. For instance, and I have five ideas here that I would like to present. But first of all, a person might live on in his works. People really want immortality. If people are living essentially pain-free, they want to live on. I mean, you could ask, who wants to die? Now, there are certain people, of course, who commit suicide. They're living in either mental or emotional or physical pain of some sort, and they might want to die. I understand that. But ordinarily, No one wants to die. We want to live on. We want to continue living. So in Psalm 49, we're told that there are some people who look to their works, what they have done in life, to kind of give them an extension on life. Of course, this is not literal. They're still dead, but they think they live on in the works that they've done or the results of their works. So in Psalm 49, verse 11, reference is made there to those who live on in that way. Speaking of the wicked, it says their inner thought is that their houses are forever and their dwelling places to all generations. They have called their lands after their own names. So that's pretty much what I'm saying, that if people themselves can't live on, at least they want to live on in some sense in their works or the results of their works, whether, you know, some construction project or some house that they have built or something else like that. It's interesting that in Ecclesiastes 2, the author mentions the futility of trying to live on in one's works. In Ecclesiastes 2, verses 4 through 11, the author talks about all the things that he had done, his works. He says, beginning in verse 4 of Ecclesiastes 2, I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself. I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself, which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. I really don't think that I need to read on. I think you get the point. Here's a man who is trying, it would seem, to capture some semblance of immortality through what he has done. So he's working feverishly in order to increase and enlarge his works. But then he goes into the futility of those works. And while I'm in Ecclesiastes 2, I'm going to read from the later portions of that chapter, beginning with verse 18. Now, he's going to be describing the futility, or why it is futile for a person to think on, he can live on in his works. Beginning in verse 18 of Ecclesiastes 2, he says, thus I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. That's a pretty strong statement. Let me interject this. That's a pretty strong statement. Here's a man who's worked feverishly, but what does he say his attitude is eventually to all his works? He says, I hated all the fruit of my labor. Well, why would he hate it? Well, this is what occurs to him. For I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? Yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor for which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun. This too is vanity. And he goes on in the same vein, saying that after he's worked so hard, then he may have, if I may put it this way, a fool for a son. And his son may squander everything that he's worked so hard to build up. You cannot guarantee, you cannot control what's going to happen to everything that you have acquired once you die. It's totally out of your hands then, and it's totally in the hands of other people. And you cannot control what they're going to be like or what they're going to do with what you've worked so hard to build up. So he recognizes that eventually, and he speaks of the futility then of really knocking yourself out in this life to build up some sort of a semblance of immortality through your works. So I got a bit ahead of myself in saying that, but there are some problems then with this concept of living on. That is the concept that says you live on in your works. Number one, your works are not going to save you. That's found in Ephesians 2 verses 8 and 9. Number two, eventually, your works, if they're not squandered and wasted, as I just said from Ecclesiastes 2, by other people, then they're eventually going to decay. Then number three, even if people do make wise use of what you left behind and they benefit from your works, you yourself, or excuse me, they themselves, the people who are benefiting from your works, will eventually die anyway. Your works are not going to give them any more immortality than you yourself have enjoyed. So, for those reasons, we are foolish to think that we can live on in our works. You know, if you were like me, you did not particularly appreciate English literature class in high school. I love reading, but English was not one of my favorite courses, to say the least. And I have never, for the most part anyway, been able to appreciate poetry. However, I think it was in high school English literature class, I was introduced to the poem titled Ozymandias by the early 19th century English poet Percy Shelley. As a matter of fact, I thought so much of it, and it has such biblical sentiments, that I put it in today's bulletin, which you won't be able to see perhaps until next week. But there's a lot of irony in this short poem. It's only maybe about a dozen or so lines, but there's a lot of irony in it because the poem describes this traveler going through the desert, and in this vast sea of desolation, the desert sands, he comes upon this broken down colossus or statue. And it's lying there broken in the desert sands. All around is a desolate landscape. And yet there is an inscription on the pedestal of this statue. And in this inscription, the king who had this statue made and had apparently created great works, boast of all that he had done. And he says, "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." He was saying, you can just look on my works, and you're going to be depressed over the fact that you can't come anywhere close to doing what I did. My works are just that great. And the great irony is that his works are basically gone, and even his statue is broken down and lying prostrate in the bleak, barren desert sands. So, and let me tell you, that's essentially what the scriptures themselves say. That if you go to, actually in the bulletin I included Psalm 97 verses 7 through 14, and as a matter of fact, it would be a good idea since this really emphasizes the point. Psalm 49, we're going to start with verse 7 and read through verse 14. I think it's worth a little bit longer reading than I usually do, but I think it's worth it because it makes the point quite well that I've just been making. Psalm 49, beginning with verse 7. "No man can by any means redeem his brother or give to God a ransom for him, for the redemption of his soul is costly, and he should cease trying forever, that he should live on eternally, that he should not undergo decay. For he sees that even wise men die, the stupid and the senseless alike perish and leave their wealth to others. Their inner thought is that their houses are forever, and their dwelling places to all generations. They have called their lands after their own names. But man in his pomp will not endure. He is like the beast that perish. This is the way of those who are foolish, and of those after them who approve their words, Selah. As sheep, they are appointed for Sheol. death shall be their shepherd, and the upright shall rule over them in the morning, and their form shall be for Sheol to consume, so that they have no habitation. Sheol, of course, is the realm of the dead. In other words, the realm of the dead, or Sheol, is going to take them over when they die. Okay, let's move on to the second point now, as to how a person can live on. He can live on in the lack of a record or others' knowledge of his death. Okay? And, of course, that was the case with Melchizedek. As a matter of fact, I pointed out at the beginning of the lesson that Hebrews 7, verse 8 uses that expression, lives on, in reference to Melchizedek. Well, in what sense did Melchizedek live on? Well, that is explained to us earlier in the chapter, particularly verse 3. This is Hebrews 7, verse 3. Without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, he abides a priest perpetually. This is a reference to the Melchizedek first introduced in the scriptures in Genesis, the 14th chapter. Earlier this year, I believe it was back in the summer, I had a lesson, summer or fall, I had a lesson on Melchizedek. Now, I don't believe that Hebrews 7 verse 3 means that he really did not have a beginning, nor that he died, because that would mean he would have to be God, because God is the only one who does not die. But it says he has no genealogy. And if you look in the scriptures in Genesis, the 14th chapter, despite the fact that he is a pretty important personage, he is the king of Salem and also a priest of God. Despite what would usually be the case, or what you would ordinarily expect, according to the custom of that day, no record is left of his mother or father. There is no reference to him having been born. There is no reference to him having died. I don't believe that that means he didn't have a mother or father, or that he didn't die, or that he was not born, but rather simply that there is no record in the scriptures of that. So he is portrayed or represented in the scriptures as if he was not born and did not die, had no mother or father. So that is how he lives on. Now, let me ask you, would you find comfort in the thought of living on only in the sense that no one ever knew you died? Well, that's a rhetorical question, of course. I wouldn't find any comfort in that, and I don't suppose you would either. Usually when you go to a cemetery and you look at the headstones, it will have, at the very least, the birth date of the person buried there and the death date of that person. We don't even have that regarding Melchizedek, nothing about his death. But would you say, okay, I want to live on, so when you put my headstone there, don't put my name on it, or don't put my birth and death dates on it, because I want to live on. I want people to think I'm living on. No, that won't do. By the way, this is a tangent. This is an aside before I move on to my next point. Let me observe here that in Hebrews 7 verse 8, that it says regarding Melchizedek, of whom it is witnessed that he lives on. Well, how was it, we might ask, how was it witnessed that he lives on? Well, really, I've already explained that. The scriptures witnessed to the fact that he did not live on. That's the only witness that we've got. It's that of the scriptures. And how do the scriptures witness that he does not, that he lives on? Well, I'll go back to verse 3. He had neither beginning nor end of days. So the point I want to make here is that the silence of the scriptures, that is the fact that they are silent with respect to his death, is a fact, is called a witness to the fact that he lives on, at least in a sense. Okay? The point I want to make from that is that the silence of the scriptures, that is what the scriptures do not say, is pretty powerful. And we need to respect the silence of the scriptures so that the scriptures, we can say, teach us by what they do not say sometimes. The reason I emphasize this, and I confess this is an aside, but I think it's a pretty important one. Some people think that, oh, they're free to act if the scriptures are silent about something, if the scriptures do not say that they can't do something, that they're free, therefore, to do it. Well, actually, the scriptures teach us by their silence. They have something to say to us, as in the case of Melchizedek here. Okay, let's move on to the third point then. A person can live on in the memory of the living. In Genesis, the 48th chapter, Jacob, the son of Isaac and the grandson of Abraham, is speaking here. This is Genesis 48, verse 16. And actually, let me see, is that the correct, makes me wonder. I'm sorry, I must have the wrong scripture down there. Genesis 48, verse 16 is the scripture that I have down here. Yeah, that is correct. That is correct. Genesis 48, verse 16 has Jacob saying, "The angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads, and may my name live on in them. And the names of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and may they grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth." So Jacob expresses the hope that his memory or his name will live on in the persons of his descendants. So there's a sense in which we can live on in the memory of others. And we try to preserve either our memories or the memories of others by memorials of various kinds. These memorials may take the form of names. That's very common. My wife was telling me that she just the other day that she thinks her middle name is derived from the name of her mother and a couple of grandmothers. So that's not uncommon. We perpetuate ourselves in a sense by giving our names or allowing our names to be taken, or anyway, they're taken with or without our permission and applied, you know, to our descendants. Sometimes we do this through memorial objects. Down in Washington, D.C., there are many memorials, no doubt. That's our national capital, so we tend to center our memorials there, our national memorials there. So you will have the Washington Monument, which reminds us of George Washington, our first president. And there's also the Lincoln Memorial. There's also the Jefferson Memorial. There's a memorial to Martin Luther King. There's a memorial to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who led us through the president who led us through the Depression and most of World War II. And no doubt there are other memorials there and in other places. As a matter of fact, I was thinking, if you come up south of New Brunswick or from the direction of New Brunswick to our meeting house, you probably cross over on Highway 18 what is called the James A. Lynch Memorial Bridge, which carries Highway 18 across the Raritan River from New Brunswick into Piscataway or vice versa. If we were at the church building, we could see each other directly. I would ask, how many of you know who James Lynch is? And I doubt I'd get a single hand up. Now, I've heard of the James Lynch Bridge there for about as long as I've been living here, I guess, which is 30 years this year. But until yesterday, when I looked up who this James Lynch was, I didn't know. I mean, this bridge is a memorial to him, but I really don't know who he is. I found out he was a mayor of New Brunswick, and he was a state senator for New Jersey. I found out who James Lynch is. But, I mean, there's a memorial to him, but this suggests the problem with memorials. You have all of these memorials, but, well, let me mention there are a couple of problems with them. First of all, these memorials don't do anything for the dead themselves, okay? I mean, do we really think that people like George Washington or Abraham Lincoln or Thomas Jefferson or Martin Luther King or Franklin Roosevelt or James Lynch are rejoicing wherever they are now? You think they're rejoicing because, wow, I have something back on earth that is named for me. People remember me because of these memorials. No, I don't think if they're in paradise, I don't think it's adding one bit to their joy. And if they're not in paradise, then I don't think it's really giving them any relief from whatever suffering they may be experiencing to think that their names have been memorialized in these forms on earth. So memorials are vain because, from that standpoint anyway, because they don't do anything for the dead themselves. But secondly, even memorials do not preserve the memory of the dead in a meaningful way. I mean, how many of us allow our lives really to be affected by James Lynch or one of the presidents or some other famous figure in American history? Some people, actually would live in such a way as to be contrary to the principles that those people, represented and for which they're memorialized and would actually detract from their works. So even if a person leaves memorials behind, there's no guarantee that people are really going to remember them effectively or in a way that would be beneficial. Okay, point number four, a person can live on in the influence his example has through his words and his works, through his influence, basically. In other words, a person can live on in others. Paul seems to be saying that that's the case with respect to his relationship with Christ. Christ lives in him. Well, how does Christ live in him? Well, through the work, the ministry Paul is doing. In Galatians 2, verse 20, he says, let me find the exact verse here, beginning of it. I have been crucified with Christ, and it is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and delivered himself up for me. But Christ lives in me, Paul said. Well, what does that mean? He is allowing Christ, the words of Christ, to control him, his conduct of life, how he lives, and what he does in his preaching of the gospel and so forth. So this is how a person can live on. He can have an impact, or his life can have an impact in the lives of others. This was most notably the case in an evil way with King Jeroboam of Israel. Two centuries after his death, it is said in 2 Kings 17, verses 21 through 23. Now, this is 200 years later. What he did 200 years before was the basic cause of the downfall of the kingdom of Israel, of which he was the first king. Now, can you imagine that? What you're doing can have a very fundamental impact upon what happens in the lives of people 200 years from now. In Jeroboam's case, it was an evil impact. I looked up the expression that goes something to the effect to walk in the ways or the sins of Jeroboam. And it occurred so much in one form or another that I was discouraged from actually counting them. But it wouldn't surprise me if that expression is used dozens of times. It's practically a formula to describe the conduct of Israel's kings who came after Jeroboam and imitated his sinful ways. And of course, what he did explained Israel's downfall. If one lives on, nevertheless, in good saving influence on others, he won't live on in this earth, but, and this introduces my next point, he may well live on in a more meaningful way. So we move now to the fifth and final way in which a person might live on. And that is that he might live on in paradise, whether this paradise is conceived of as heaven or as the blissful part of the realm of the dead. Because paradise is used in reference to both. It's interesting that the scriptures teach that the dead, in some sense, continue to live on, particularly the righteous dead, I should say. In Matthew 22, verses 31 and 32, Jesus is responding to an argument from the Sadducees about the resurrection of the dead. And to show that the resurrection of the dead is something that is plausible, he points out that it is plausible from the viewpoint of the fact that there is a sense in which the dead do live on. So if a person dies but continues to live in some form somewhere else, though not perceived by us, why should it be thought strange then that God can raise the dead? Anyway, that's Jesus's argument. But for our purpose, I just want to point out that Jesus shows that the dead do live on in some sense. In Matthew 22, beginning with verse 31, he says, "But regarding the resurrection of the dead, have you not read that which was spoken to you by God, saying, 'I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living.'" So Jesus's point here is that at the time God spoke those words, "I am the God, I am." Now notice this is pretty important. That's the present tense. He doesn't say "I was." He says "I am," not past tense, but present tense, "the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." So his point is, he is, even after Abraham and Isaac and Jacob had been long dead, still God was their God, even though they were dead. Now, if Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob don't exist in some sense, then God is the God of the dead. But since it is not possible that God is the God of the non-existent, then in some sense, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob must still be living. Of course, we understand this more from other texts in the scriptures. In Luke 16, verses 19 through 31, we have the story of the rich man and Lazarus, how the rich man died and went to torment, and Lazarus was carried by the angels to a place called Abraham's bosom, which in other places is called paradise. Okay. Or at least one other place is called paradise. So, this Lazarus was, as Jesus describes him, in a place where he was enjoying comfort. He was living on. But not only that, There are a couple of places in John, the Gospel of John. First of all, John 8:51 we'll look at, where Jesus says that people, those who believe in him particularly, will not die. In John 8, verse 51, Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he shall never see death." He'll live on, in other words. That's another way of saying he won't see death. He won't experience death. He will live on. If you've got your Bibles physically open there, you might want to keep your finger or keep that page anyway in John 11 and compare this to John 11, verses 25 and 26, which is a parallel passage. In John 11, verses 25 and 26, it says, Jesus is speaking here to Martha, the sister of Mary and Lazarus. It says, "Jesus said to her, 'I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me shall live even if he dies, and everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die.' Do you believe this?" Now, as we close out the lesson, I want us to notice that these two passages are parallel. Jesus says in John 11, verse 26, "Everyone who lives and believes in me will never die." Some people might say, well, all you have to do to live on eternally is just believe in Jesus, and they take that belief in a very absolute sense, meaning they don't have to do anything to obey him. They just have to believe in him, you know, give mental assent to the fact that he is the Son of God, for instance. And that's all they need to do to live on and never die. Just believe in Jesus in the sense that I've described. Well, look at the parallel passage again in John 8, verse 51. Where Jesus says the same thing to the extent that he says, such a person will never see death. He'll never die. He'll live on. But notice, instead of simply saying believe, he says this, "Truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he shall never die or see death." Now, When you compare those two parallel passages, John 8:51, John 11 verse 26, John 11 verse 26, you can see that Jesus defines what it means to believe in him. It means, or it includes, keeping or obeying his word. So this really is the only way that we can meaningfully move on. And Jerry, you can go on to the conclusion then. I've mentioned five ways in which people might live on, but the only meaningful way in which people can really live on is the one I've just mentioned, where because of their faith and their obedience, they can paradise, ultimately in heaven. And so we need to bear in mind that Jesus defines, though, this faith by which we can live on as keeping his word.